And then you have the flip side of that coin is a technology that was developed to adjust the pitch of sonar underwater to find underwater oil deposits being hijacked by Cher to correct the tone of her voice. That's where autocorrect comes from.
Really?
Yeah.
Her autotune?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Autotune, yes.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah, it was developed to adjust the pitch of sonar to better detect underwater oil deposits. And then the music industry was like, or we could, can you believe in life after love?
I mean, you know, por que no los dos? Why can't we do both?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, I'm bi and polyamorous. Like, why can't we have everything?
Yeah.
Do you stim when you worship? Tick when you pray? Info dump theology or think you might be gay? The autistic mystic.
Welcome to the Autistic Mystic. My name is Jeff. I am the Autistic Mystic, and today I am joined by the amazing Ray Antonoff Portnoy. Ray is a Jewish educator and curriculum writer who works at an LGBTQ synagogue in California. They are an amazing artist and a great follow on TikTok if you have a TikTok. We had such a fun conversation talking about how Christians can respectfully engage with the Hebrew text without appropriating it, and neurolinguistics, and so much more. And it was one of those talks where at the end you keep saying, okay, we should go, and then you talk for like another half hour and then say it again and repeat the process over and over again because the things we're talking about are so fascinating. It was so fun. In fact, I don't want to keep you from it any longer. So buckle up, grab your noise-canceling headphones, and prepare for this week's info dump. Here's Linguistics and Context with Ray Antonoff Portnoy. Thank you again for being here. This is wonderful.
No problem. Thanks for having
me. I'm super excited. When I found your TikTok channel, I was very excited because you have just enormously informative and entertaining content.
Well, thank you.
And I learn just a ton watching your videos.
I have resigned myself to being an edutainer.
As much as I
used to get salty about the term, and I used to get a little salty about like, oh, he's an edutainer, not a real educator. Like, but the right. reality is that every educator needs some amount of entertainment in order to be effective.
Yeah.
Like, how do we learn? Like, my most effective teaching tricks for Hebrew are what I call silly Hebrew tricks, which are like mnemonics that are like, you know, like bet has a big butt. Like it right. makes kids giggle and you remember it forever.
Right. Yeah. Well, and like, even like in like doing, like when I would do stuff like on a worship team or something like that, I have resting bitch face. Not a term I love, but like a term everyone's going to understand. And so
as a linguist, I have a love-hate relationship with those terms where it's like, this is problematic, but I'm not going to be prescriptivist about it if that's what people understand.
Right, exactly. And so like, it, like just if I'm concentrating on music and making it good, I don't look like I'm having any fun. And so I had to like really add a performative level to it when I'm playing in church, because if I smile, people are able to connect with the content more than if I'm standing there with like a scowl on my face because I'm concentrating on nailing this riff or something like that. And so,
And there's miles of difference between like telling the cashier to smile and needing to be a performative presence.
Right.
That requires like a friendly face. Cause like I will snap at some random person on the street who tells me to smile.
Right.
But like if my supervisor says, you know, the kids are having a little trouble connecting because you seem to like not be smiling as much recently. First of all, my direct supervisor, the direction of the questioning, thank God for this job, is that her question would be, is everything okay
right.
if you're not smiling enough in class? And second of all, like, can we work on making sure that, you know, like you're able to project as much warmth as you feel, even if it's not natural on your face. But like some random person on this, God bless masks. No one's told me to smile in so long.
I love masks. I don't think I will ever stop wearing one because I part of my autism is like, I have a tiny little bit of Tourette's, like officially diagnosed. I'm not just being like, oh, I'm so, like when people are like, oh, I'm so ADHD, and they don't have ADHD.
The spectrum.
Like, yeah. But like, I do have like a diagnosed amount of
of Tourette's syndrome where I have facial tics. And I usually, like I was mocked to scorn as a child for doing it. And so I learned to mask and hide it. And I it just like explodes whenever I'm by myself. And now I can just do it under my mask. And no one knows what I'm doing. And to the point, though, where I've gotten too comfortable with it. And I was at work having dinner, and you have to take your mask off to eat, obviously. And my coworker was like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, why?" And like, "Your face is like, you look like you're in pain." I'm like, "Oh, no, no, I'm just autistic. Sorry."
That's just the RBF. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially as a an AFAB femme raised in the South, I had the RBF smacked out of me young.
Yeah. So part of why I wanted to bring you on is because you are a Hebrew language educator and a Jewish person, and so much of what Christians are doing with the Hebrew language and the Jewish texts is horribly problematic. And so I wanted to...
As with everything, there's a spectrum. There right, are people yeah. who engage with the language and the texts very respectfully and very much understanding the backdrop from which they come, and people who are just say, "Oh, this is interesting. Let me take it and run with it and pretend it's mine."
Right. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like a certain TikTok man who will go unnamed.
It's unnecessary to bring in what we call a Shon Hara, naming the names with the evil tongue, as long as we call out the activity.
Excuse me. So part of the discussion I wanted to have, though, is like how can Christians engage with the Hebrew text and the Hebrew language? Because like so many people don't even know like that we like Christianity completely rearranged the order of the Hebrew text to point to Jesus, like to make it like seem more obvious that this is the, like, and so when they're like talking about and even I didn't know this until recently, when people are like, because there's a movement within Christianity to stop calling it the Old Testament and to start calling it the Hebrew Bible, and then I've heard a number of Jewish creators be like, it's not the Hebrew Bible, like that's still like the Christian Bible. And so like what's her name, the mom millennial on TikTok is like just call it the Tanakh or call it the Torah, and like
if you're talking about the Hebrew Bible, so it's one of those things where in scholarly and academic conversation, Hebrew mm-hmm. Bible does refer to the Jewish Bible,
right?
In the order of the texts and the inclusions and exclusions that involves, that would be Tanakh in Hebrew, because that's right. An acronym for Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. The Torah, the teachings, the Nevi'im, the prophets, and the Ketuvim, the writings. And then, but then in academics, you'll also get plenty of a little bit of mix up of, does Hebrew Bible mean the Christian Old Testament?
Right.
Or because those texts were originally in Hebrew? Or does that mean the Bible that is used by the group that studies it in Hebrew all the time?
Right.
Which isn't to say that other groups can't study it in Hebrew. Like, Hebrew's a language. Anyone who is capable of learning a language can learn Hebrew enough to study Torah in the original language. Mm-hmm. You just need to make sure that your sources are somewhat veritable and know what they're talking about, and hopefully have some at least minimal concept of the fact that modern Hebrew and biblical Hebrew are completely different linguistic eras. And so a word that's used in the Torah, even if it is used in modern Hebrew today, the same root and the same word with the same vowels could have a completely different meaning.
Right. And like in the same way that like, and because Hebrew spans such a broader time period than English does, but like when people think of Old English, they think of Shakespeare, But Shakespeare is not
that's old modern English. English.
Yeah, that's modern right. English. Like old, I have one of my professors was fluent in old English. And that's like,
and you know, Beowulf.
Beowulf. Yeah. And he would like, just like recite Beowulf. And you, I don't understand what he's saying. And
yeah, like yeah. It took us 6 weeks in class to go through even like part of Beowulf, like
right.
In AP literature class. Like that's not, it's not an accessible text to modern audiences without a lot of contextualization. And like, even at a high school level, clearly it was for the like advanced studies kids. Like the, you know, at least in the state of Georgia public schools, they did not require Beowulf of most graduates.
Yeah, no, definitely not in Canada either. Everyone had to read Lord of the Flies and like Grapes of Wrath. And that was basically their requirement.
I think we had to pick one of those two. I don't think we had to read both of them.
Okay.
I think we were... It was like a summer reading where you pick between those two and The Great Gatsby.
Right. Yes. I did have to read The Great Gatsby as well. And I did not. But I did very poorly in high school. So.
Whereas I love school and loved high school other than a few select teachers.
Right. So I went to
and classmates.
Yes.
Because it was Georgia.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I went to an arts high school, so I was like the straightest one there, which was a miracle. but the other thing was they would encourage you to like utilize your art in your academics, and so I would very often, if I had to present a book, I would read the back of the book the morning of, bring in my guitar, and then improvise a song that referenced the back of the, like what I read on the back of the book, and I would come away with like a 75 from those, and I'm like, that's good enough. But it was a very bad precedent to set because right. then I couldn't do that with every class, obviously. And then I right. didn't really learn how to study. But when I got to university, I did very well in university because I was actually interested in what I was studying, and I was financially invested in doing well. So but yeah, I was really lucky, I think, to have like the main prof at my school who taught Hebrew really did, like there were a lot of sort of supersessionist theologian type professors at the school. And Dr. Driver, who taught Hebrew, was very much like understanding what was being said in the context and not reading Christianity back into the text. At the time I was a very conservative evangelical person. And so I was like, but why? And as I came to like understand the text more and understand things, like just under like modern Christianity, the conversation I just had before you jumped on was all about how evangelicals are essentially Gnostics because they have like the secret knowledge that only they are right, and
whereas like, in every single Jew-centric or Jew-founded like Discord server I'm in that has any sorts of roles about like what kind of Jew or religion you are, like almost right. every single one has some sort of role that's like agnostic, but then again, who isn't?
Right. Yeah.
And like, I've never met a Jew who wasn't at least agnostic, if not atheist.
Right.
And honestly, if there's a Jew who claims to be completely Gnostic, like they're either lying or selling you something. Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah. And so like, but like the idea that like,
and they could be lying to themselves, to be clear.
Right.
But like, they're either lying or selling you something.
Yes. Yeah. Which is what we were saying about evangelicalism as well. But, like the evangelical notion of like the spirit being separate from the body and escaping to heaven instead of like, engaging with stuff here. Like that was all. So I was trying to read that back into it. And then finding like what sort of the Hebrew texts were actually saying about stuff, and realizing like, oh, not a lot of this modern Christian ideas are found anywhere in the Jewish texts. And
2000 years is a really long time for theologies to diverge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, of course, course, there are some core overlapping components, like, you know, right. The golden rule is in, I haven't met a single religion in the world that doesn't have some sort of version of the golden rule, right. Like do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or the reverse, do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Like whether it's in the double negative or the double positive, like I haven't met, like studied a single faith in this world that doesn't have something along those lines,
right.
Because the point of faith is to help us A, find meaning, and B, pursue a better life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we pursue a better life by creating a better world. And we do that by treating others at least as well as we would want to be treated.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, even though there are some of those overlapping core things, like there are certain values that are very much Jewish values that even the most deconstructing Christians are kind of like, huh, yeah, that's not ours.
Right.
And, you know, like even, and ones where like the supersessionists will try to claim, be like, we have something like that. And I'm like, do you really though? Because your concept of charity is completely different from our concept of tzedakah.
Right.
Like we mistranslate tzedakah as charity all the time. And it, but like, I will never translate tzedakah as charity for my students. Never.
Right.
Because it's a completely different concept. It's an obligation. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we do out of the goodness of our heart. And in fact, like, you know, one of the biggest debates I'd have with classmates, like my Christian classmates in school and grad school and even in high school, was that, like, well, essentially, like, is it better to give $5 happily or $100 begrudgingly? And my Christian classmates, I mean, this was, again, Southern Baptist, mostly evangelical classmates that I grew up around, would be like, well, $5 gladly, because it's the spirit of it that matters, not the material. And right. Judaism says, okay, but $100 given begrudgingly does 20 times more good for the person right. than the $5 given happily. Like, who cares if, like, the person who's receiving the money doesn't care how happy you were about it.
Right.
They care how much food it can buy them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is, like, within the Christian mind frame, I think that is a misunderstanding of that. Like, it's a verse that says the Lord loves a cheerful giver. And so that's, and I'm sure he does. Like, I'm sure they do.
And Maimonides, absolutely, like, in Jewish thought, lists, like, different levels of tzedakah. Like, it is absolutely a higher level to give joyfully, like, to give a great amount, to give a lot joyfully and anonymously in a way right. that produces self-sufficiency is the highest level of tzedakah. Right. Every single one of those that you ding down takes you down a level. Now, it's the bottom level where you are giving very little begrudgingly only because you're told to and only because you get credit is still tzedakah.
Right. Yeah.
It's still doing good for the world. How you feel about it doesn't change anything. Like, it's basically the core concept of impact over intent.
Right. Yeah.
That, like,
and I think, like, something you were touching on, like, about sort of like what got us onto this, like, even when you were saying, like, when people try and align the two faiths and they're like, well, we have something like that. Like, I think it was in one of your videos where you said, if you're a Christian, name one Jewish value.
To be fair, duetting another creator, Butterfly Astrophysics, who is amazing. And that right. was her phrasing okay, of okay. that. But, like, I absolutely 100% signed. I don't do many duets because I'm so committed to caption accessibility and the captions don't transfer.
Right.
So I only duet videos that I have the energy to manually caption
yeah.
alongside it, which is yeah. Especially when I have a joint dislocation disorder that and I can't feel half of my left hand at the moment. So I'm like working one handed on everything, which is part right. of the reason I'm on TikTok, because I can hook the phone on my two good fingers of my left hand to do everything with my right. Whereas right. like my computer video programs, like I need both hands.
Yeah.
So like, you know, like I have a left hand, but like these three fingers are useless. So.
Right.
Whereas like the TikToks are a little more accessible for that.
Yeah.
And now my brain just forgot where I was going with that.
No, that's okay. But so, yeah, but it was the name one Jewish value. And,
oh, yeah.
And even me, I was like, I could name several from Second Temple Judaism. I don't know if I'd be able to name one from modern Judaism.
Right. And aside from maybe Sadaka,
but yeah.
Yeah, and Second Temple Judaism is absolutely part of both Christianity's and Judaism's shared history.
Right. Yeah.
100%. And in fact, modern Judaism and like rabbinic Judaism was in many ways a reaction to the way early Christians interpreted Second Temple Judaism.
Right.
And so much of early rabbinic Judaism in the like second through sixth centuries was all about like, okay, so these Christian folks are sort of basing things on similar values, but clearly you're taking it in a very different direction than we did. So how can we put up more fences? And it was a self-protection measure. So a lot of the early rabbinic laws were about how do we not look like the goyim?
Right.
And like in some ways it was intended as a very much like, how do we maintain internal cultural cohesion when we are a stark minority, always have been, always will be, mm-hmm. unless something drastically changes in the world.
Right.
Like Jews are 0.2% of the worldwide population, and 2% in America. So like there are 10 times more Jews per the population in America than the world proper or right. the world overall. And yet, you know, I've certainly been places in this country where people have never met a single Jew before me.
Right.
And so like, if they're just, they're so different now, but a lot of that is because the early rabbis in the second through sixth century, when rabbis started being a thing at first as a mm-hmm. thing, right. where the term rabbi, we use it today, started to develop. The word existed before that, but it didn't have the titular meaning that it does now, where they started making like Jewish legal decisions, or not really even decisions. Decisions is absolutely the wrong word. Jewish legal debates.
Right.
And Judaism is very descriptivist. Like we put out the debates and then we decide who wins by whose decision gets used the most.
Right.
Like there's a, you know, there are great rabbis like Hillel and Shammai who went at these, like they were frenemies before that term existed. Like they loved to fight with each other, and yeah. the texts show it. Like they would get vitriolic towards each other and also effusively loving at the same time, and like talk about each other as their brother, you know, as their non-blood brothers, and at the same time their mortal enemy,
right?
And that, you know, like in Judaism there's this, like when you're studying you're not supposed to passively take in information. We learn things by debating, and sometimes our emotions make the language in that debate charged, and part of Jewish debate is learning to look past the immediately charged language to the like intellectual core, because right. we were all created in God's image, and in part of that image includes fierce emotions, so that too is holy, and we can get past the defensiveness of those emotions to look at the meat if we know how.
Right. Something that came to my mind when you were talking about the advent of rabbinic Judaism, being part of that being like to a self-defensive measure to separate yourself from, am I allowed to say goyim?
Oh yeah. By the way, like as far as I'm concerned, as in my worldview at least, there are very few Jewish stereotypes that are completely based in reality, but one that is two Jews, three opinions. So I will never claim to speak for all Jews in anything, and if I do, it must be a very bad day where I messed up. but. At least in my estimation, like the word goyim just means non-Jew. Like
okay.
It's a completely value neutral term, and it can be used snidely just right. the same way white people can be.
Right.
Like I'm white.
Right.
I like glow in the dark. If I'm pulled over by a cop, I'm going to be treated like a white lady if I cry. Like,
right. Yeah.
I completely recognize that. But at the same time, when I'm in Georgia and when, there are surrounded by Southern Baptists and like classmates telling me like, oh, you're not really white because you're Jewish. Like, what?
Whiteness is such like, a weird...
And it's one of those things where I was like, do you see me? I glow in the dark. Like, I'm whiter than you are. You tan more than I do. Like, little Miss Southern Baptist Barbie. Like,
whiteness is such a weird concept because, like, there was, there's a podcast called Behind the Bastards.
I love that podcast.
Yes, it's so good.
I don't listen to podcasts much, but that is one I will make an exception for.
Yeah. And so Robert Evans was talking one time about how there's, like, these weird, like when people are like, oh, I'm not racist, I have a black friend. And there was like writings about that, about Hitler, but his black friend was Mussolini. So yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes the ridiculousness comes from inside the house.
Yes. but oh yeah, what I was saying, the differentiation as a defensive measure. Does that,
which to be fair, that also like that well predates the rabbis, that is in the Torah.
Well, that's what I was gonna ask. I was like, is like, does that tie back to Leviticus and stuff? Because when they're like, they're like, do not do what your oppressors did, like
90% of the holiness code and pretty much almost every single verse that homophobes, transphobes, etc. try to point to, like every single one of those, like if you look at it in its context, is a sumptuary law, it is a differentiative law, it is a spiritual purity law. It has not, like Leviticus 18:22 is entirely about spiritual purity and differentiation from the oppressors and nothing to do with consensual loving relationships.
Right. Yeah.
Like if you look at all the other verses, it's all about sexual impropriety so that your soul doesn't become impure before you do your sacrifices at the temple.
Right.
And like, if you're not doing sacrifices at the temple, why do most of these matter?
Right. Yeah.
And to be fair, there are plenty of those that we do still follow. Like, you know, we still, like where it says not to uncover your father's nakedness, like that's a euphemism for don't sleep with your father. Like we still shouldn't do that, but for reasons other than just because the Torah says not to, frankly.
Right.
Like we should not do that because it's like unethical and immoral and like causes genetic problems.
Yeah. That's just a bad call all around, like regardless of the context. Like, yeah. Which I find really interesting because why I think it could be important for Christians to understand the Jewish text in its context more and understand the Hebrew is like when you're reading like the story of Noah and his son uncovers his nakedness and Christians are just like, oh, that's weird. He saw him naked and then his generations are cursed.
How prudish are they that they think that just seeing him naked, like, no, you have to know some of the literary.
Yeah.
Like some of the figurative language that was used at the time. And there's a lot of it, like, you know, the amount of merisms that are used in there, which are the like from, you know, the from like the A and Z, meaning from A to Z construction is all over the place.
Yeah.
Like God created day and night. What about dusk and dawn? Those exist. Like God created land and sea. Well, what about swamps? Like, are you denying that swamps exist? Like, no.
We interrupt this podcast for another installment of Mystic Moment.
Hey friends, I want to take a minute to highlight something that Ray is talking about here. God is so much more creative than we give them credit for. And when we see these merisms in scripture, it's God creating two extremes of a thing to unlock the spectrum of all things. God created day and night, but like Ray said, we don't deny that sun rises and sunsets exist, and those are typically considered to be the most beautiful times of the day. God created three colors, red, blue, and yellow, but those three colors unlock the full spectrum of color. So when scripture says that God made male and female, that's not prescriptive. If everything else in all of creation exists on a spectrum, why would gender be the only thing God made binary? So I want you to take a minute and put aside any presumptions you may have about how God creates things and just get lost in the infinite nature of God's creativity and goodness. And to all my trans, non-binary, and intersex siblings, I happen to think you are the most beautiful part of the day. Okay, back to the show.
I saw something recently that made me laugh so hard, and it was the inference that because it only mentions God creating the birds of the air and the beasts of the sea, so like chickens and ostriches and emus are abominations because they're birds of the land, they're not the beasts of the land,
they're not
birds of the air.
And yet chickens are mentioned explicitly in the kashrut laws for what's kosher, right? Because so like land animals and sea animals have like a rule that can be applied. Birds don't, though. It's just a list of here are the birds that are kosher and here are the birds that are not. So there's always one of my favorite debates among modern rabbis is whether turkey is kosher.
Oh, really?
It wasn't discovered, so it's not on either list.
That's so fascinating.
And some rabbis argue it's basically a giant chicken, right?
Yeah.
And others argue, no, it's a completely different species. And like it eats completely different things, and not 100%, but like 90%+ of the kosher animals, or kosher birds rather, are vegetarian. Right. And 90% of the non-kosher ones are scavengers or predators in some way.
Right.
And turkeys. That basically... And, you know, like my seminary professors taught it as that originally in Noah's time, we were supposed to be vegetarian. And then later on, we were allowed to start eating meat, and the kashrut laws came in to sort of differentiate that. But essentially, there shouldn't be more than one step between us and vegetarianism.
Mm-hmm.
That like our food should be vegetarian, even if we aren't.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting.
And again, which is not about a health issue. Like a lot of modern Jews like to be like, oh, it's healthier to do that. And it's like, I mean, maybe it is, but that's a like secondary benefit, if anything.
Yeah.
It's about this like spiritual purity of that, like we respect where our food comes from, and the scavengers and the predators like have their own ecosystem where if we start eating those predators, we could throw off the ecosystem.
Right.
And like, so if we start eating all of the animals that eat other animals, the animals that need to be pared down are going to start ruining the environment as well.
Right.
So we only eat prey.
Right.
With a few exceptions. There are a couple that don't neatly fall into that, which my seminary professors would have probably been like, well, they didn't have scientific taxonomy at the time, and they didn't have like scientists researching what each of these animals ate.
So would that have been like... So when Samson scoops the honey out of the lion, was that like a shocking thing for him to have done because it's from a predator, or is that?
Not necessarily, because that's also a tale of like strength and overcoming.
Right.
That is almost certainly an allegory.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty fine with a lot of both the Hebrew and the Christian text being allegorical, but
yeah, and even if you do take it as literal, like you could even take it as that, like, sure, consuming something like that from like lions aren't kosher, so like technically, even touching a lion isn't kosher.
Yeah, well, and I always found kind of like Samson's story is like the hair was like the last straw. Like he had already broken sort of the other two pillars of the Nazirite vow.
Oh wait, that... I just realized I spoke a little too quickly.
Okay,
cats like lions are. There are three levels of purity when it comes to animals. There's tameh, which are like there's the ones that are actually like pure enough to eat. Mm-hmm. And then there's the ones that are like not that are impure. And there's like two levels of there's like too impure to eat. But like then there's another that's like you're allowed to touch them.
Right.
Like this cat here. but I'm not allowed to eat her.
Right.
Aren't you happy for that?
Her ears are so good. For Samson, I always kind of felt like when he lost his strength, it was just because like that was the last part of the vow that he broke, because he like you're not allowed to touch dead people, but he killed 1,000 people with the jawbone of an ass. So like that's touching a lot of dead people. How
something unintentional that I did with this podcast, but that I'm really digging and might just keep going with it. Everyone on the show so far has been queer, including yourself. I know there are branches of Judaism that are not LGBTQ friendly, but how does your sexuality tie into the expression of your faith?
So in my experience growing up, it was very much they were very much intrinsically related. I grew up in the Reform movement. My mom also went to Reform Seminary. So I'm a third generation Reform synagogue professional. And like my family has been members of the Reform movement since Germany in the 1800s when it was founded. So like the progressive Judaism thing is like in my blood. And since I was raised by a professional Jewish educator who went to Reform Seminary, it was very easy to make sure for my mom to make sure that I had access to accepting communities. And my mom always worked at the synagogue we belonged to. And basically I was the Reform Jewish movement has been LGBTQ plus friendly since at least the 70s. And has caught like and started proposing like actual resolutions in support of like legal protections for LGBTQ plus people starting in the 90s. I believe late 90s. I'd have to look at the platform. And then I know I voted on one of the final versions of that resolution in 2004.
Nice.
As a youth delegate at the time. So like basically the Reform movement has been very pro LGBTQ identities since I've been aware of it.
Okay.
In my 34 years of life. And like I came out first at Jewish camp.
Oh, nice.
I had my first crush on a girl at Jewish camp.
Yeah.
One of my cabin mates. And like spent like 2/3 of the summer being like, but I have a boyfriend at home. What are these feelings? I don't understand. I can't have a crush on a girl. That's not how this works. But, you know, like I was at a camp that literally had what they called the alphabet soup group. Like there were queer kids and counselors who met like twice a week just to chill in one of the lounges and just be queer together.
That's amazing.
And this was,
the
I guess,
summer
like
camp version of the Alphabet Mafia. I love it. Okay.
Yeah. It was before the Alphabet Mafia. Like, you know, these are totally, this is totally the teenagers who would have been the people to start the Alphabet right. Mafia term if this had been today instead of 2001.
Right. I find it really interesting that.
20 years ago. I've been out for 20 years. Dang.
Wow. When did I come out? I came out. I learned what a bisexual was when I was 16 or 17, and immediately I was like, oh, that explains what I am.
Yeah. And then, within like I think it only took me like 2.5 out of the like 6-week session for me to get past my internalized homonormativity.
Right.
and be like, but I have plenty of gay friends, but that's not me.
Right. I unfortunately was in the evangelical church and so I shoved it all down. Right. No.
Well, of course, this was, I went to very liberal Jewish summer camp in upstate. Well, New Yorkers would get upset with anyone for calling this upstate, slightly outside of New York City.
Okay.
Is 90 minutes outside of New York City. So
okay.
Anyone who's not from New York calls it upstate, and anyone who's from New York will smack you if you do that. So it's not far enough out of the city for that. So like I went to this really liberal Jewish camp in the Northeast, but then at the end of the summer went back to Marietta, Georgia.
Right. Yeah.
Which admittedly, like for a suburb in Georgia had a much higher Jewish population than many parts of Georgia, but that is not saying much.
Right.
So
yeah.
like very stark minority at my school growing up. And so when I was first coming out, I encountered a lot more homophobia and biphobia from my non-Jewish classmates than I did from any Jewish peers. But that's also because I didn't have much exposure to Orthodox Jews I wasn't related to until college.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's where I started to gain a little bit more understanding of just how much diversity of belief and thought there is in among Jews and Judaism.
Right.
And like I'd sort of like understood Orthodoxy in the abstract, but I didn't really interact with any Orthodox Jews besides my first cousins, because my first cousin married a modern Orthodox guy. And so we sort of like adopted a side of the family that's very much modern Orthodox. Like the men shave using electric razors for the most part, because that's not a blade, so you're allowed to do that. Okay. And like my first cousin doesn't cover her hair. And so she and I have actually had this conversation a lot about like the difference, that it's really funny that she married Orthodox and doesn't cover her hair. And I went to Reform Seminary and married a completely non-religious person and do.
Right. Yeah. But
part of the whole Reform theology is that like there are all these Jewish practices, and the things that are meaningful to us, you do. Right. And the things that aren't, like, you don't have to feel guilty about not doing them.
Right.
Like my first cousin is made to feel guilty all the time about not covering her hair. Whereas if I decided to take off my hat tomorrow, no one would care.
Right. Yeah.
Not a single person would say, but you're married. Where's your hat?
Yeah. And I'm sort of,
and this is in no way, by the way, to in any way denigrate Orthodox belief or Orthodox Jews in any way. Oh, yeah. Just, it's one of those things where like, this is the reason I'm not Orthodox.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sort of seeing more value in that approach within, like, again, like having been raised evangelical, I was very much in the camp of like, well, there's one way to believe. And if you're not doing these things and believing this way, then you're wrong. And I think part of why we're seeing more, or we're noticing more deconstruction, I don't actually think there is more deconstruction, I think we're just noticing it more, is because we have this ability to communicate with people across different faith traditions within our own belief 100%. Structure.
Yeah. And without leaving our living rooms.
Right. Yeah.
Like when I was like, and it's one of those things where whenever, so as an educator, I often do a lot of, I do some like educational consulting, and I do a lot of professional development workshops with other Hebrew teachers. And they like to, and the curriculum that I developed and I'm usually training them on like uses a website and an app that is accessible on all devices. And part of my training is like, here's how to use these apps so that you can coach your students through it. And like almost, I wouldn't say every time, but like 90% of those workshops I do, I have the opportunity for a teachable moment whenever someone goes, oh, kids these days and their devices. And I have to be like, excuse me. People said that about newspapers.
Right.
People said that about books.
Right.
About the printing press. Like, whenever there's a new way to communicate and provide information in a way that is more accessible, people whine about kids these days getting lazy. Right. And it's never true. Never.
Right.
Kids these days read more words per day than kids in the 80s did.
Right.
And kids in the 80s were the, like, hide in our books generation.
Yeah. And like, so for me, I discovered in my last year of university, which I discovered it earlier, but that like I process information better when it's read to me and I'm doing something that occupies the distractible part of my brain. And so I will listen to audiobooks and draw at the same time. And I listen to that, and I always hear people being like, well, audiobooks isn't really reading. I'm like, really? Because I could read a book and not absorb any of the information, whereas and it would take me like a week to do it, whereas I can knock out an audiobook in a day or two, depending on the length, and like fully absorb
it's one of those things where sure as someone who is into neurolinguistic educational development, like, yes, it's not reading in that it's not engaging the same neural pathways
right.
as we're teaching when we teach reading in school.
Right.
But that's not what people mean when they say that's not real reading. There are no true Scotsmiting
right.
reading. And yeah. like any no true Scotsman argument is inherently false.
Right.
Like, with very, I guess I can't really, like, basically, you know, like every generalization has, like every generalization is false, including this one. like there are going to be exceptions, but we make these generalizations for a reason.
But we also have to be careful about them. Yeah. And if we're like, what's the point of reading? If it's to absorb the information, then we should do it the way that that's actually going to happen. And it's like, what's the point of like learning Hebrew the traditional way that these people had to back in the 80s or whatever? Well, if it's more effective to do it with this app and with these like devices, then like, why not? And especially from like a neurodiverse perspective.
A Hebrew primer, like a printed textbook, can't read the word back to you to tell you how it's pronounced at your own pace.
Right.
This app, you tap the word and it pronounces it for you, and you don't have to guess what sound it makes.
Right.
You can have it pronounced for you in the proper accent. And like kids who go through, like there are so many, like, you know, one of my whole things is also like that it's self-paced learning, not self-taught. Like, right. You are not teaching yourself. You are pacing yourself through the material with regular check-ins from a real live teacher, hopefully.
Right.
But like between those check-in points, like you can tap that word once and get it, or you can tap that word 20 times until you get it.
Right. Which is really important.
And I also think that it's very un-Jewish to poo-poo the way that younger people communicate, because Judaism has historically said, oh, a new way to distribute information, we want it all. Like the instant the printing press came around, Jews were like, oh my god, we can actually like make Siddurim and prayer books and like actually keep them in the synagogues, and not instead of just having one person up front with one copy and everyone else memorizing the prayers,
right?
People can actually read them now. Like, we don't have to, like, and to be fair, that had a, so like on the one hand, that made services far more accessible. On the other hand, it meant that Jews no longer felt pressured. So there are so many Jewish traditions, and I think in every religion, of like, you know, adding your own twists to your worship belief. Every generation, and for instance, in the Torah, even it says that, like, you know, every generation is supposed to turn it for themselves. And like, it's not in the heavens that you, like, every generation, l'dor v'dor, is supposed to, like, from generation to generation, we will reinterpret the text and reinterpret the tradition and find our own ways to connect to it. And for many, many generations, there was essentially this, like, kind of check and balance of, well, we can't make the service longer than people can memorize.
Mm.
And then as soon as the printing press came around.
Sure we can, yeah.
We no longer had to make sure that the service was only as long as most people could memorize.
Right.
So services started getting longer.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like 14th century synagogue service was probably no more than 30, 45 minutes long. Right. Until the Torah reading, like, you know, the Torah reading will take a long time, but that's not the service. That's like reading from the text in a public ceremony. And up until the printing press, essentially, like, that was the vast majority of the time spent in communal worship environments, was studying the text together.
Right.
And running through the prayers was almost like a, like, let's quickly daven, and like the leader will like give, basically the leader will just give a couple lines out loud so that people can like keep up with the group, but you're basically doing it on your own from your memorized thing.
Right.
And then we come together for the Torah study, and like only in, like, people don't realize how modern it is in Jewish practice to have a physical book in front of us that has all of the prayer options that the rabbi or cantor or shalichat tzibur or whoever is going to pick.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
this is a new technology, relatively speaking, in human history. And like, we've only been on this planet for a drop in the bucket in comparison. And like, every single one of these technologies, like, yes, can be used for unpleasant purposes. And with the proliferation of any new communicative technology, you get a lot more crap.
Right.
As soon as you had the printing press, you had a lot of really stupid pamphlets coming out. As soon as the internet was accessible to everyone, you got stupid clickbait websites.
Right.
But or like on the other side of the coin,
even TikTok itself is like such a good example because there's such good informative information on there, and yet never has there existed a worse hive of scum and villainy, right? Like
right. And but I mean, and this happens, by the way, if you haven't read or watched the TED Talk by Clay Shirky, called The Cognitive Surplus, best 20 minutes you could spend in your life. If you are into like how the internet has changed our communication styles and the benefits it could have, there's a whole book that I had to read for grad school that is also worth reading. And there's also audiobook versions of it, that it's called The Cognitive Surplus. And the whole theory is that like, basically as society develops, we find technologies that make daily life take less time to make happen.
Right.
And now that we, you know, now that we have farmers producing our food instead of each of us subsistence farming in our backyard, and now that we have like a computer that can read something to me if my eyes are acting up, et cetera, right. Like I don't need to be like, when, for instance, my sister's dyslexic and had textbook readers in college, like having her textbooks read to her was how she learned. And right. Like now you can, now there's an app that will, you can, you don't even need to hire someone. Like I used to do textbook reading, and like the disability support services would send me a textbook and a couple blank CDs, and I would have to record the textbook. But nowadays right. You have good enough technology that you can feed in the manuscript and it will produce a human sounding voice for it with inflection and everything.
Right.
It's an expensive technology and it's becoming more affordable. But every time this technology becomes more affordable, you get more free time.
Yeah.
And with that free time, you also get more like capacity for mental labor as well as the physical. And so now that we like so much of this technology and communication can happen so instantaneously in ways that used to take so long, we have an ever-increasing cognitive surplus in the world where we have minds and free time to work on things that aren't strictly needed just for putting food on the table.
Yeah.
And that will create everything from his sort of like spectrum at, this is going to date when this came out a little bit, but like on the one end, you have lolcats. A little silly and like kind of like side-eye a little bit, like, I mean, like as a descriptivist linguist, I love it because I think like lolcat speak is hilarious and so charming. But like, I totally understand when people are like, ugh, about it. 100%. It's silly. It's stupid. But like, that's what makes it fun. But so that's one end of the spectrum. And then on the other end, you get like crowdsourced apps like Ushahidi, which was entirely developed by programmers, et cetera, in their free time through open source that was developed as a way to track when violence occurred around polling places in countries that didn't have free elections were trying to pretend they had free elections and didn't really. Right. And so especially in countries where women were attacked more frequently going to the polling place. And so it started out as tracking violence around polling places. And then as it grew and as they got more subscribers and more users, they were able to turn it into a flat out, basically like there's you can now use it as essentially a map of where any type of violence tends to happen more or less frequently in some areas that Google Maps hasn't gotten to yet.
Right.
Like you can't find these places on Google Map other than through satellite view. They don't know the streets there, but Ushahidi has a like very detailed map of like, okay, here's where the most sexual assaults occur. Here's where the most muggings occur. And like, you know, here's where the most violence against women tends to occur. Here's where the most children seem to be harmed. And at least until that part of the world has a government that can provide justice to the victims of those crimes, the best weapon we have is using a little bit of technology to at least communicate when these things happen and where right. and to find the patterns.
Yeah.
And absolutely like saved the election in some countries a couple years.
Yeah.
Because women were able to get to the polls and survive the experience.
Right. That's amazing. And then you have the flip side of that coin is a technology that was developed to adjust the pitch of sonar underwater to find underwater oil deposits being hijacked by Cher to correct the tone of her voice. That's where autocorrect comes from.
Really? Yeah. Her autotune?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Autotune, yeah.
Sorry. I did not know that.
Yeah. It was developed to adjust the pitch of sonar to better detect underwater oil deposits. And then the music industry was like, or we could, can you believe in life after love?
I mean, you know, por que no los dos? Why can't we do both?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, I'm bi and polyamorous. Like, why can't we have everything yeah. if everyone consents?
Absolutely. Oh, man. This has been wonderful. I don't want to keep you too long because your spouse is... It's their birthday, but I very much enjoyed this conversation.
Of course, I hope we got to enough topics for you to make an episode out of.
I think so. Yeah, like I mean, and like I think like part of it is like yes, we talked about Hebrew, we talked about everything else, like a bunch of stuff, but like getting into like that the neurodiversity of like learning and stuff like that, and the different like that's still a huge part of like. What I'm passionate about and like understanding. Right. And I think it has a huge application to faith and to learning about learning scripture and stuff like that. And because like we don't study scripture in a vacuum
I think also working with like neurodivergence, which on that end, like I've had like a really funny aha moment recently. Where like, but if you know anything about neurodivergence, work with neurodivergent people or have any sort of understanding about neurodivergence, like it teaches you to be aware of the variety in the human experience.
Right.
And like, it teaches you to realize, oh, the way that I perceive the world is not necessarily how someone else perceives the world. And that's okay. Right. Like in a value neutral way, as mm-hmm. opposed to some of the like, oh, you see the world differently than me, and that means you're going to hell.
Right.
Like that's not a holy approach to take. Like,
yeah.
First of all, Jews don't really believe in hell, but like right. if we did, like, I'm not going to go there just because of whatever you think I.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. it's going to be because I like, I don't know, contributed to a genocide or something.
Like, yeah.
I'm you know, I very much try not to do.
So I reject the concept of hell altogether.
But I mean, like, you know, like, and I think that with working with neurodivergent students for right. so many years has really trained me to be a lot more understanding of just how many different ways the human brain can think.
Right.
And that like, I mean, it's now funny that for years I thought I'm just really good at working with my autistic students. and then I get the referral to get assessed myself and right. I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, it's like,
let's just reframe my entire life now. It's fine. I've only done that once a decade since I was born. It's fine.
I had at one point, one of my youth groups that I was running had over 50% of the kids were autistic. And then my kids were diagnosed with autism. And my spouse was like, I think like you just have this natural gift. And it must have been like, because God knew that your kids were going to be autistic. And so like, you're so good at connecting with autistic people. And then we're at the doctor's office. And the doctor's going over different traits we can expect to see like that are typical in autistic kids that age. And I'm just like, well, that's just all normal kid stuff. Like I used to do all that stuff. I still do a lot of that stuff. And he's just kind of looks at me like, mm-hmm. autism is genetic. And I'm like,
yep.
So I didn't get diagnosed until I was in my 30s.
Yep. Like, well, that's where I'm at now. And especially since the diagnostic criteria really didn't, incorporate AFAB masking.
Yes. Yeah. So it is getting a lot better, but even still though, depending on who you go to, like I've had
people. Oh, I'm being super duper careful. So like, yeah. I have my referral that I'm not going to cash in until I know I have the right. Cause like once right. I take that referral to a specialist, they would then have to release me right. in order for me to get assessed by someone else.
Right.
So like by my insurance. So yeah. I'm basically like, I'm not even going to go in for my initial intake until I know I find someone who specializes in the diagnostic process for AFAB femme people.
Right.
Like,
yeah. Because I know a lot
and
of people
so much of the like, formal diagnostic criteria still don't encounter like include a lot of the yeah. AFAB research. And so you need to find someone who is willing to take the extra, like the outside the DSM criteria as well into right. consideration because like, yeah. No, I don't have trouble making eye contact.
Well, that's it. I know so many people who've been rejected, who have not received diagnoses is because they make eye contact. I'm like, I make too much eye contact. Like,
yeah, like it's basically like for me, it's like I'm either making too much or not enough and there's no right in between. But yeah. like I was so trained that the way you talk to other human beings is you look them in the eye. And like at first I was like, okay, this is weird.
Right.
But like eventually I got used to it because I noticed that I was treated better when I did it.
Right.
And like, yeah. so that's a self-reinforcing mask.
Yes. 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
And like, you know, now that I have the language to apply that to, like, I've been using this language for my students for years.
Right.
And like, it's so funny how it just takes like one, in fact, it wasn't even my therapist. It's one of my partners who's a therapist who was like, have you looked at this list before yet? And I was like, I mean, for my students, yeah. And he was like, have you looked at the list for AFAB since it's been updated? And I was like, what? And he was like, talk to your therapist about getting a referral. Like, I think you need a referral from someone who already treats you. And she was like, you know what? I'm not really sure, but let me look at the criteria again. And she like did some homework over the week and she came back and she was like, I looked at the new AFAB criteria. Let's get you a referral.
Right.
She my was like, oh my God, I'm so glad that you made me do that homework because now I think right. I can work with so many more of my patients so much better.
Yeah.
She was yeah, like, I just hadn't looked at it in 5 years and they updated it five right. years ago.
Right. Yeah. My spouse also like is neurodivergent for sure, has ADHD, but recently has been looking into possibly also getting diagnosed or going through the assessed. Diagnostic process. Yeah. Getting assessed. And I wouldn't have ever guessed that they were. And then they were just telling me, and we had all these moments years ago, like leading up to my diagnosis where like we were sitting on the porch one day and they're like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm just, you know, when you get really tired and you can't see faces anymore. And they're like, no.
I and know.
And then so like now we're having more conversations about like how they process things. And I forget what exactly it was that they told me, but I was like, it was something about like eye contact and how they make eye contact. And I was like, oh. You're absolutely autistic. Like, yeah, let's get you assessed. And there's like these stages of like, I think I might be autistic. No, I'm just a poser. And so they're in like the no, I'm just a poser place right now. Right. And so
well, and for yeah. years, like, especially as an educator who like works with so many introvert, like, especially since I work with so many kids whose families don't have access to the diagnostic right. processes. Right. So my approach to education is like, frankly, I built my entire school so that it's accessible to my autistic learners because my neurotypical learners will benefit from the same accommodations. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't hurt any. There are some oppositional accommodations that mm-hmm. do conflict. For instance, if you have a hard of hearing student who needs higher volume with an autistic student who needs lower volume and gets overstimulated, right. those are actually contradictory accessibility needs.
Right.
But that's like 1%
right.
of the accessibility things that you could do in a learning environment or any environment whatsoever. Like, it doesn't hurt your non-dyslexic readers to have more white space on the page and use a bigger right. font. Like, it yeah. doesn't hurt your colorblind or your fully color vision students to have no important information in reds or greens. Like,
right.
or right. to make sure that if it's reds or greens, it's fine if it gets interpreted as gray, like
right.
That like it's not like you don't need to see the red or green to get the information. Like it doesn't yeah. like it doesn't hurt walking people to have a ramp into a building. Right. Well, okay. Again, there are exceptions. Like as someone who uses a crutch, sometimes ramps are harder for me than stairs. But you know, like for the most part, like, but I can navigate the ramps and I can't always navigate the stairs.
There you go.
And so the ramp theory is a big thing that I talk about as an educator too. Like, let's just build ramps. Like it doesn't yeah. hurt. It hurts so few people to build those ramps.
Yeah. And to not have them hurts so many more.
Yeah. And yeah. like having the, and like, so I've had all of this language for my students and have been like, oh, like I've got some students who are definitely diagnosed autistic. Some that are very strongly suspected, but don't have access to it. Some that are, it's really hard to tell if they're just really introverted and good at masking or like actually like on the autism spectrum. And then you've got the like ones who are like, definitely just really introverted. Right. No other autism traits, just like
right.
really, really introverted kids who get drained by social things and energized by alone time and like by definition introvert. And so for ages 20 plus years, I've thought that's ever since I heard the word introvert, I just thought I was like, oh, I'm very extreme on the introvert
right.
scale. And that like, and you know, the skills I'm using right now to be able to have this conversation, not be stumbling over my speech, not be starting my sentences over all the time, and not just clam up, were very actively developed by me at some point being like, everyone has this massive fear of public speaking, and that seems so silly. How can I make sure, like, what's the best way to get over that? It's not yeah. something that's actually traumatizing, so let's do exposure therapy. And so I joined the speech and debate team.
There you go.
And it was terrifying.
Right.
Terrifying at first. But then junior year, I won state.
Wow.
In original oratory, or no, senior year, sorry. Senior year, I won state in original oratory for a speech. And like, so I went from, you know, 9th or 10th grade being the sort of, you know, the introvert who was so shy, like not in, like beyond introverted into shy. Like my parents had to pay for caller ID before it was affordable, because I would not pick up the phone if I didn't know who it was.
Right.
And I was like, I'm not going to pick up the phone for a stranger. Well, it's, but right. It's 5:30 PM on a Thursday. I'm calling you on my way home, or like, as I'm leaving work, like it's always the same. And I'm like, but it could be someone else who just happens to call at the same time. And they're like, so my parents were like, fine, we will pay for this newfangled caller ID system that is super expensive, just so that our preteen daughter will answer the phone when we call from work. So I went from there to now, like, I, you know, like I've been a keynote speaker at national conferences. Like,
right.
They're, and so like, and I think that something about the autistic mind, like the autistic brain isn't necessarily bad at these skills. We just have to go about learning them differently.
Exactly. Yeah.
And like, we don't just pick them up naturally. Like yeah. a lot of neurotypical, we do pick up some skills naturally that neurotypical people don't.
Right.
And there are some skills that neurotypical people pick up like this. Like my sister, clearly very neurotypical. She understands, like she speaks Southern.
Mm.
Very well. She knows exactly every single time if someone in the South says bless your heart, she knows 100% of the time whether they mean it genuinely or in the
snarky
like basically like, you know, because yeah. it can be like, oh my god, you've been taking care of your kids who've been homesick for a week and now you caught it too, oh bless your heart, that must be awful, like that's authentic.
Yeah.
But then there's also the like, so you were the maid of honor and planned her entire thing and she couldn't even be bothered to come to your baby shower. Oh, bless her heart.
Right.
Like that's like, unless it has that much context, I cannot tell the difference.
Right.
My sister knows 100% of the time, even when that's the only sentence said.
Yeah.
And like, and it's now I'm starting to reframe that. I was like, oh, she's neurotypical and those sorts of social skills are more natural to her. Whereas yeah. I have to read about it in a book.
Yeah. Oh,
before
I'm so
I understand it. I have to read psychology textbooks to understand neurotypicals.
I picked up sarcasm pretty well when I was a kid. because
it's a defense mechanism.
Well, as a defense mechanism, and also because usually it has such like a pronounced inflection, like if people are doing it right, it's like it's way over the top. I don't know if it's doing it right,
especially when they're doing it to kids, because they know that kids are. Now, I also was okay with it as a kid. I started having more trouble with it when I was a teenager and in college, when people started doing more deadpan sarcasm,
right?
And the like, do you want to? Or like, do you want to get pizza again tonight? No, I was just going to go hungry. Oh, okay.
Right.
Of course. Of course I want to order pizza again tonight. It's D&D night. Of course we're going to order pizza. Oh, well, I couldn't tell if you were tone of voice. I'm sorry. And like if you had said, no, I'm just going to go hungry tonight. Like, of course I would have gotten it.
Right, right.
Like, sarcasm doesn't go over my head. It's just that like I need very clear tone cues in order to catch it. And I'm now married to someone who is an actor who uses that deadpan sarcasm all the time. And now after 9 years together, I'm finally starting to catch on to when it's happening every once in a while, I will actually catch on to it before I respond as though he was being serious and have to catch myself.
Right. That's so funny. Oh my gosh. Okay. But, well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Of course.
And I'm looking forward to, do you want to plug anything before I let you go?
Sure. So my art website is rayanndesigns.com, and I have been a little bit behind on filling those orders as I've been a little bit sick, but I'm hoping to do some catch up soon. I will be filling mostly Hebrew calligraphy and micro calligraphy artwork. But I also got some English pieces and a bunch of Pride pieces as well.
Nice.
I will be promoting a lot, especially next month for Pride Month.
Wonderful.
Because don't support so much of the corporate Pride merch so much as you support actual queer artists.
Yeah, let's do that. That's good.
Yep. And I'm sure you already know this, but my TikTok is rayanne.designs. However, you can also be the first or second publicly available people to know that I will be changing my TikTok username soon.
Oh, very cool.
I'm going to change the designs at the end to edu.
Okay.
So nice. It'll be rayanne.edu, which I've already got the website for. So
nice. Very nice.
rayanneedu.com. Rayanne.edu was way too expensive for me.
Okay.
They wanted like $15,000 for that. And I was like, no.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's a short URL with an edu.
Right.
So it's, but like rayanneedu.com was available. So I got that.
There you go.
It's not built yet. Don't look at it. Okay. I'm still working on it, but maybe by the time you actually get this posted, it'll be up. But yeah, so I'm going to be changing that suffix on my thing to .edu because although I will not be changing my content at all. I will still post some of my art. I've discovered that most of the people who just find my account for the first time are doing so through my educational content.
Mm.
My followers definitely appreciate my art, but I'm gaining very few new people from it.
Right.
So I've decided that I'm going to, you know what, if people are finding me for my educational stuff, let's make it obvious that I'm an educator and not just an artist who's pretending to educate.
Yeah.
Which, you know, artists can absolutely educate, but like I have a master's degree.
Yeah.
It's up there. I paid for that thing in thousands of dollars in blood, sweat, and tears. So I'm going to use it.
I love it.
I've got 4 degrees and only 2 of them fit up there. So. Slash the other 2 are not even framed.
Oh yeah. I haven't framed mine. I was, and I had to, like, I'm going through an ordination process cause I left my non-affirming denomination and trying to switch my credentials over to an affirming one.
Mazel tov.
Thank you.
Or Yasher Koach, I should say. Go forward in strength.
And they needed my diploma or like my degree. And it's in a box somewhere because after I graduated, I was like quite disillusioned. And someone had to tell me like, you shouldn't badmouth your school so much because it lessens the value of your degree. And I'm like, I guess that makes sense. But I was like,
yes and no.
Yeah. Cause I was like,
we only criticize the institutions we love.
Right. 100%. And like
we don't love an institution, we just give up on it.
Yeah. And like Tyndale has amazing profs. And if it wasn't for like the small class sizes and the like intimate relationships with the profs that I had, I probably would have not been there. But at the same time,
and like the seminary that I went to, I like I've been like, there are some things that like, if I'm in with the right people in the right audience that I know, and that I know it's not like on a social media post where something could go viral, and then like, so like I will only post such things at friends only for now, at least, about right. like some really disgusting ableism at the seminary that I went to. And like, right. I won't get into more details beyond that in a publicly accessible forum, because I don't think it's necessary until like, I'm actually working with a couple other alumni to sort of be like, can we like put something together as a like, we only criticize the institutions we love. Like, we criticize America because we love it. Like, right. we criticize the Israeli government because we love the Jewish people, and we want there to be a great Jewish homeland state, but it's not there yet. Right. Like, and like, we're constantly like tweaking toward perfection, and you don't criticize the things that you don't care if they improve.
Right.
And so like, basically a couple of us like, who are disabled alumni of the seminary are thinking about like putting together a letter and be like, okay, here are the things that we experienced. We are only letting you know about this because we love this institution and we love the training that you are offering, but we also want to make the experience better for the next generation of students who may need disability accommodations. And here's the ways that you're supposed to do it. And here's the ways that you did it.
Right.
And you notice how they don't align. Like,
yeah.
And like, you know, it's one thing to like, obviously like there's academic rigor to every program, but right. you can't just brush off every disabled person as unable to handle academic rigor.
Right.
Like every time that they, like every time I needed to miss a Talmud class because like my EDS specialist who is 8 months booked out was only able to meet at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday.
Right.
Like, yeah, I'm going to go to that appointment.
Right.
I am going to miss Talmud class once.
Right.
Oh, you must not be committed.
Yeah. Really?
I'm not committed, even though I spent $40,000 on this degree after my 2/3 scholarship.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is like when you're training people for like ministry work, like it's one of the lowest paid professions in the world and some of the highest tuition in the world to get that education. Yeah. So
it's especially ironic to me when a seminary that trains pastoral care professionals isn't understanding of disabled students.
Right.
Like, how hypocritical can right. you be that you want to train the people that you send to hospitals to work with chronically ill and disabled people for a living?
Right.
And you won't be understanding if they have a chronic illness or disability themselves.
Right.
And like blame it on them not having, like not being up for the academic rigor. Like, no, I'm up for the academic rigor. I'm not up for the physical rigor.
Right. Yes.
There's a massive difference.
Yeah.
Like I cannot physically sit in a classroom for 8 hours a day.
Right.
My joints will not let me. I will be in so much pain.
Yeah.
Like I need to be horizontal a good chunk of my day in order for my hips not to dislocate.
Right.
Like I can't just be sitting in some school chair for that long.
Yeah.
And like my insurance won't cover a wheelchair that's properly fitted for me yet because
right.
American insurance isn't dystopian nightmare. And like, even though my physical therapist has prescribed one, insurance won't cover it because I can walk.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I won't be able to for much longer if I don't get to use a wheelchair on my bad days. But
yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's a whole other hour's worth of a conversation right
yeah.
there.
Yeah, there's that. So, so for the answer the unasked question, yes, I'd be more than willing to come back and chat again. If you know,
like, I would honestly love that. No, I would honestly love that. Yeah. Especially because like my spouse, SJ, when we first got together, they had a really rare nerve condition that required a wheelchair. But they could walk. And so we'd be at the grocery store and I'm short, they're tall. They'd stand up and grab the thing off the top shelf and we'd get the dirtiest looks. And I'm like, this is all the energy they're going to have for the whole week. Like, we spent the week's worth of energy at this hour long shopping trip to get frozen peas, right? Like,
sure, I could walk myself around the classroom, and like, honestly, like, I'm this close to just like buying a cheapy wheelchair and slowly buying the right, like saving up for the right, like orthotic pads and whatnot I would need for the right hip support, because like your standard folding wheelchair is really bad for someone with dislocating hips. Right. Like it's ultimately going to cause more harm than good, which is why my physical therapist was kind of like, don't just get any wheelchair. Like you need this expensive one, and that's why insurance is going to deny it.
Right.
And so like part of me is like, you know what? Like obviously it's bad to use it every single day because it won't be properly fitted. But if I get one of those folding ones and get the right like tush cushions, that and like the right lower back support to add into it,
right,
that would be a little more affordable than the $15,000 titanium wheelchair.
Right.
That like custom fitted one, but I could still like then at least on the really bad days when it's a choice between being able to teach in my classroom at all versus not leave the apartment.
Right.
It's definitely better for me to be in a less than ideal wheelchair.
Right.
Than for me to have to call in a substitute teacher because I can't walk down my stairs.
Yeah.
Like yeah. I can teach without walking. I don't need to walk to teach. It's not like, like I used to work in custom framing, and like a frame shop, you kind of need to be able to move around the frame shop. And like, now would not be able to hold that job. It is too physically demanding and requires too much standing. And it is not able to be like, you are not able to accommodate a wheelchair in that, in a frame shop. Right. Like it's not safe. Like there's too much glass around for wheelchair wheels to be safe. But also like now I use a single crutch when I move around, and it's not safe to walk around in places where there's probably broken glass when your crutch could fall. So like there are definitely jobs where my inability to walk regularly would get in the way. Teaching isn't one of them. You need a brain more than that. But like, but insurance doesn't understand that I'll be able to pay their premiums better if they get me a wheelchair that will keep me working longer.
Right. Man. Well,
I could probably do a 3-hour thing on the American dystopian healthcare system.
Well, I would definitely love to have you back to talk about that.
And or more Hebrew. This is my problem with TikTok, is that like I can never, like people, when I first got onto TikTok, people were like, you have to pick a niche. And I was like, okay, I guess my niche is art. And then I was like, I kind of want to experiment with other content. And I was like, let's see. And then my like other stuff started taking off, and I was like, it's also like not predictable which of I've now got like 6 different niches, and like I can never tell which one's going to take off. Like, what am I, like a story from my custom framing days, like got like 200,000 views, and I was like, what?
Like when it's just I got on
a retail horror story.
When I got on, I was doing like LGBTQ encouragement stuff, like God loves you, like God loves bi people, God loves gay people, God loves trans people. And then I did one that was me saying, cause there's a verse in Romans that's like, the gospel is, a stumbling block, to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. And I was like, okay, so like going off the foolishness part, and I'm like if someone ever mocks you for like, if a biblical literalist ever makes fun of you for not believing what they believe, just remind them that they worship a cosmic Jewish zombie who will let them live forever if you psychically ask him to be your lord and master while he rids the world of a dirty force that came into existence when a woman who was actually a rib was tricked into eating fruit from a talking snake. And then I was like, and I believe those things too, but I can see that they're ridiculous. And then I, and then somebody commented and was like, really, a talking snake? And I was like, well, maybe, but here's this really obscure theological thing about snakes and theology. And then that blew up, and now all I do is obscure theology videos.
I mean, like, you know, I've basically every time I gain like more than like 1,000 followers within like 48 hours, basically like anytime one of my videos like seems to get bigger, very shortly after that I often like either repost or make or like remake some version of the "Hi, new followers, just so you're aware, you probably came here from X content that just went
viral."
I don't want to say viral, like my big, like 200,000 yeah. views is the largest I've ever had. Like I've had two videos pass 100,000 views and that's right. it. So far, maybe three, but anyway, like every time I'm like, hi, just so you know, you probably like my biggest one was like an EDS put a finger down challenge was right. the biggest one I ever had. That was like 250,000 views. And after that, I would like post videos like, hi, you probably got here for my EDS put a finger down challenge. Just want you to be a no. Just want you to be aware that I have five, like I definitely do disability content, but I've got five more lanes, Jewish, queer, art, nerd stuff, and cats. And like, no, I'm not a cat account, but like, I'm also not gonna, like, I like posting my Catter Day weekly cat right. video. And yeah. like, especially since on Shabbat, like I'm not, I don't, I, like, I'm not Shomer Shabbos. I don't keep Shabbat strictly, but I do very much try to make sure that, like, something is different about Shabbat yeah. that makes it more restful and rejuvenating. So, like, I make sure that, like, on Saturdays, like, I never work on any TikTok content that requires more emotional or mental labor than a cat video,
right.
unless I really want to. Like, if I'm hyperfixating on some piece of content, I don't make myself put it off till after Shabbat, because I'm like, you know what? If I'm like when I was nerding out about some like linguistic thing, like I made a 3-part series and I recorded and edited on Shabbat and posted it on Sunday. And like my reasoning for it was that, like, you know what? This is the Shabbat thing I want to do for fun. But like,
right.
it's because this is the one I want to do for fun. Like, I'm not going, like, I'm certainly not going to reply to any of those jerks who are being like, what's your opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict? And please distill it into a minute. And I'm like, in a minute? Are you kidding me? I've had right. 25 years in the Jewish educational world. And I still don't know how to fit that into less than a 90-minute workshop. Like, right. I right. lead these things for a living. And, like, it just also boggles my mind so hard when people are like, why don't you post about it? I'm like, I haven't done TikTok, but, like, have you checked my Twitter? Have you checked my Instagram? Have you checked my Facebook? Have you checked all the op-eds I've published in multiple newspapers
right.
throughout the past 20 years? Like, my first op-ed got published when I was 14.
Right.
have been very politically active and very politically vocal for a very long time. TikTok is just not the platform I'm doing it on.
Right. Yeah.
But.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, I'm sure we could commiserate yeah. and kvetch at each other for hours if we had the time.
The other thing,
it's getting late for you.
I keep forgetting that that you have a specialty in linguistics, do you know about? I'm sure you do. This is a dumb question. Performative linguistics, which is like, yes, we should. I'm fascinated with the concept of yes. performative linguistics and how it ties back into the creation narrative. So maybe that could be another thing for another day. But
yeah, that one I might need to like brush up on some of the right. jargon around performative linguistics, but that's something that I could definitely. Get yeah. into. It's just it's been decades.
Oh yeah, it's been since yeah, it's been like 10 years since I've looked at it too. But I just it's something.
Yeah, like I finished my last master's degree 7 years ago.
Okay.
And so, but also linguistics was not my most recent degree.
Right.
My most recent was the Jewish education degree.
Okay. Yeah. It was. Yeah, I think it was probably like 10 years ago that I looked at it, but it was it's been something that stuck with me, especially because like when I do weddings, that's an example of performative linguistics is like mm-hmm. I now pronounce you spouse and spouse, and then they right. are. So yeah, anyway, cool. I will let you go because it is getting very late for me. But I've
and enjoyed it is time this for us much. To have a little birthday dinner. But thank yes. you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. This has been great.
I hope this gave you enough. Audio oh, yeah. and is, video this footage
is,
for
this is more than enough.
A good
this
episode. Is amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Have fun Hi, with editing it. And this is Mimi, who Hi, is Mimi. My or Hermia, aka Mimi, who is also the floof, who is the most frequent visitor for my Zoom calls. Hi. Well, hi. I hear those purrs.
Very cute. Okay. So,
I mean, like teaching on Zoom, I will say in many ways, like virtual teaching and running a Hebrew school over Zoom sucks. in right. so many ways.
Right.
But I get to see everyone's cats and dogs.
There you go. Yeah.
Like, just the amount of times that, like, I will gladly take my class being interrupted by someone's cat or dog walking in, as opposed to someone pull my hair again. Like, I would love to see your cat rather than deal with who was teasing who first in the kindergarten right. classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Granted, I also don't teach kindergarten. I am the principal, and I hired a kindergarten teacher because I specialize in ages 9 and up.
There you go.
Developmentally.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it is a very specific skill set to, and like, even as someone with kids in that age group, I'm like I don't know how to, it's like keeping your attention is impossible. So
I have all the formal training for working with kids in that developmental stage.
Yeah.
It's just that I did all of my, like, you know, actual research projects on specifically like 9 to 14-year-old
right.
Language learners.
Yeah.
Was really, like, basically I was focusing on how 9 to 14-year-olds incorporate a second alphabet.
Right. Yeah.
I am considering PhD, and I've already sort of got the, like, research line I want to do, which would be sort of expanding on that. And instead of doing, like, research review, being able to actually set up my own research project.
Right.
And actually, like, get access to an fMRI machine to see how the brain works when it's incorporating a second language between those fun. Ages.
Yeah.
Because that's what I got to do in my previous linguistics program. I was actually at first, I was a test subject, and then I graduated into being one of the research assistants for an fMRI neurolinguistic study.
Very cool.
Which was really cool. So actually, I have somewhere, I'd have to find them. It's from years ago, but somewhere I have, like, digital images of, that's how he diagnosed me with misophonia accidentally.
Wow.
Was that I was a neurolinguistics test subject, where they were just basically, like, the whole thing was they stuck you in an fMRI machine and with headphones on, and they would play various, it was mostly phonemes to like see where the brain lit up. But as a control, they also had environmental sounds. And so, like, there were things that were perfectly fine, like water dripping or a running toilet or, just like a simple, like, clickety, like a clock doesn't bother me, like, yeah, the second hand. But then it got to, like, sounds of, like, what sounded like chewing gum or crunching food or anything like that. Like, my amygdala lit up like a Christmas tree. And they were like, are you okay? And I was like, I mean, I hate this noise, but I'm fine. And they're like, have you heard of the term misophonia? And I was like, miso what? I had miso soup.
I love it. I've heard misophonia is actually closely related to synesthesia, though, which
yes,
is interesting.
Neurologically, yes. It's essentially, and part of what the neurolinguistic researchers, like, started geeking out at me after this happened about, because I was like, you know, first or second year undergrad in linguistics at the time.
Right.
So these were, you know, like, seniors or grad students who are, you know, several years ahead of me in the program. And they, like, knew that they had a sympathetic ear for this geeking out. And so, like, as soon as we finished mine, like, I was the last one of the day. So they were totally fine with me just, like, hanging out and geeking out with them about it. And they're like, yeah, like, you know, usually, like, we're mostly trying to figure out, like, what, like, you know, where the plosives versus the, like, various, like, formations live in the brain. But, like, there's all of this, like, it's all about, they were like, do you have any sensory processing disorders? I was like, I've been diagnosed with auditory processing disorder since I was pretty young.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, so they were like, immediately, like, okay, so it's in the same family as far as sensory processing rewirings as synesthesia.
Okay.
Is that, like, you know, a certain sensory input, instead of going to the part of the brain that will interpret it as what it is.
Yeah.
Just someone's, you know, popping some gum, And instead, it'll redirect it to the fight or flight region. And that's why I get irrationally ragey when people are loud eaters. And like, I work with kids and I have to push past it because I can't tell, especially disabled children, you can't say, chew with your mouth closed.
Right.
Like, I'm not their parent. Like, I can do that to my own kids when I'm parenting them. I can't do that to other people's children.
My spouse also has misophonia, and I chew ice cream, like, with my mouth closed, but like, I chew ice cream and I'm not allowed
You're one of those types.
I mean, they won't let me eat it in the same room as them. So
there are certain things where I have to be like, are you eating that? Oh, great. I'll be in the other room. See you later.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one.
Like, enjoy your peanuts and pistachios. I'm going to be in the other room. Enjoy your goldfish crackers. I'll see you in an hour.
I love it. Okay, I'm going to go chew some ice cream. And
yeah, have fun with that.
I will.
Good night. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. This has been so much fun, which is why we keep going and talking longer, because it's just so much fun. But
you want to hear my favorite joke ever that I'm allowed to tell because I'm Jewish?
Yes, go ahead.
What's the difference between the British and the Yiddish?
I don't know what.
The British will leave without ever saying goodbye. The Yiddish will say goodbye without ever leaving. On that note, and that's how I leave parties. So
I love it.
That's right, how I make myself leave parties. So bye.
That's amazing. Bye. We did it. Congratulations. That's our episode for today. Thank you so much to Ray Antonoff-Portnoy for geeking out with me on several subjects. If you want to find them online, you can visit rayandesigns.com. That's R-A-E-A-N designs.com. You can also find them on TikTok. Depending on when you listen to this, it's either at rayan.designs or at rayan.edu. At the time I'm posting this, it was still at rayan.designs, but they did mention they were changing it. If you want to find me online, you can find me at CFC_PastorJeff on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, and pretty much everywhere. I also now have a Facebook page that is just CFC Pastor Jeff with no underscore. You can find this podcast and my other projects at theautisticmystic.ca. You can find the church that I pastor, Chosen Family Church, at chosenfamilychurch.com. If you want to join one of our Sunday services, which we run every other week, you just click the Join a Zoom service link at the top of the homepage and fill out that form, and we will send you the Zoom link and password. And if you like this podcast and want to help it succeed, you can help me by leaving a rating and review on the platform you access the podcast on. Ratings and reviews help the show get discovered by new people, so go forth and do that, s'il vous plaît. I also now have a CFC Pastor Jeff Discord that I will link to in the show notes, and we are creating some really cool community there. We are praying for each other, we're posting memes, and currently, at the time of recording, we are doing a Bible study on how the Bible subverts the gender hierarchy of the ancient world and argues for gender equality, not the subjugation of women as is taught in so many churches. Until next time, remember that you are the sacred image of God, the chosen vessel of the Holy Spirit, and the way God interacts with creation, and so are the people you hate. Love ya.